So you want to turn to the book of Lamentations. We'll be in chapter 2 today. And for my Wednesday night class, we were talking about atheism, and then we got on to the subject of homosexuality. And for those of you that are on Facebook, I encourage you to follow, I thought it was Kathy Faust, but it's Katie. Okay, so from what I can see so far, I would recommend that you follow her. She was raised by two lesbian women, so she knows how it affects children, and she's speaking out about it, and seems to be pretty good about articulating it well.
Hey,
yes, sir.
I got the new Sports Illustrated, and Sportsman of the Year was that soccer girl, a lesbian.
Oh, is she? Okay.
Stomped on the American flag when you won.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, she's the Sportsman of the Year.
Oh, wow. Okay, let's begin by praying to God on here on December 15th. Lord God in heaven, we know that the Bible, the book we call the Bible, is your word. And we know that you, through your infinite wisdom, use the Spirit to make sure that these five poems that we call the Book of Lamentations ended up in the Bible. Because you wanted the whole world to know about the words of this book, not just Israel, but you want the world to know what was said. And we know that you want the church to know what was said here. So help us to understand these words and see why it is that you want us to read over these words and to think about them. Help us to gain the message. Help us to know what to apply and how to apply it. We need your guidance. We need your spirit. We need your wisdom that we might have the necessary insight to be the kind of people that you want us to be. And that we might be the kind of people that everyone around us needs us to be, oh God. Through Jesus we offer our prayer. Amen. Okay, so remember, as I mentioned in my prayer, and I've said in class already, that the Book of Lamentations is a collection of five poems. And the first four are based on what? They're an acrostic based on Do you know what an acrostic is? The first acrostic I ever became familiar with was in the home of Earl Harrington, that I told you was the guy who taught me and just died this past week. And in his house, they had a fane up in the on a picture or whatever hanging up on the wall that said joy. Jesus first, others second, and yourself third or last. That's an acrostic where you kind of, sometimes you'll spell a word or you'll do something and then you make a thing like that. So verse 1 in the first four chapters of Lamentations starts with what letter? In the Hebrew. You can't see it in English.
Yeah, well, it's hard to see it in the Hebrew in my Bible because it's in English.
So what did I tell you the whole poems are based on?
The Hebrew alphabet.
There you go, the Hebrew alphabet. Okay.
But we can't see that.
Right.
Oh.
But that's just something you need to know.
Okay.
Okay, and chapters 2, 3, and 4 mix up the alphabet a little bit. Do you remember at what point, what numbers, what verse numbers? What was that? 16 and 17. For some reason, Jeremiah switched those two. I haven't figured out yet why, but I know he had a reason. If anything, just to make us stop and think about it. You know, what is the purpose of poetry? Have you ever thought about that in the first place? You know, prose is what we're used to reading or writing. But some people put things in poems. Hebrew poetry is not the same as English poetry, yet they're both designed to do the same thing. To make you stop or slow down in your reading and think about the imagery that is being presented. Prose, you know, we try to read through it as fast as we can. But poetry is intentionally designed to make you stop. You shouldn't read it fast. Because the poet, well, think of Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd. Okay? What did David want you to do at that point right there?
Stop and think about it.
Think about what?
The Lord being his shepherd.
Yeah, okay, so what is a shepherd? David was a shepherd. Okay, so he's trying to give us some insight as to how he looked at the Lord. The Lord is my shepherd. What does a shepherd do? Well, that's really what the rest of the psalm is about, okay? That here's what all the things the Lord does. But David could have written it in prose and said, the Lord makes sure that I have everything that I need. But then we would just say that and we wouldn't stop and talk about it. So he wants you to use your imagination. You see a shepherd, and right now in my mind, I'm in Israel at that archaeological site that we were at, Tel Beth Shemesh, and down the hill, I can see a shepherd with his sheep. That was so awesome to see that. You saw it too, didn't you, Denise? Do you remember? I just thought that was awesome. You know, in the land of Israel, of all places. So I just absolutely love that. And I have this image. I wish I could have watched them all day or all week or something. But that's what David wants you to do there, okay? And that's what's going on in Lamentations. Lamentations, for example, is not like Romans. Romans is where Paul is doing expository writing. He's explaining to you God's plan of mercy to save man. And he starts you at a certain point and he presents arguments. Some of it you'll get some pictures, but most of it is to think about the argument, how one thing leads into another. But Lamentations, like Psalm 23, for example, is not written that way. So keep that in mind when you read Lamentations. I should have mentioned this last week. He wants you to see the imagery that's there. He wants you to see what he's talking about. So use your imagination. Gene, you had your hand up earlier. Yeah.
I see a shepherd. I see the green pastures. I see the still waters. The way it just brings it to our mind as a picture.
Yeah. And it's kind of also a story, you know, and stories have a way of lasting with us. Now, Lamentations will do some explaining, but that's not its purpose. The poet here, Jeremiah, I believe is the writer, he wants you to feel what he felt. And part of the way of doing that is to present to you pictures and to express the feelings of his heart. Romans is not like that. Romans is, I mean, there might be some feeling in there, but for the most part, it's knowledge. You need to know this, and you need to know why this preceded this and everything like that, okay? Nancy.
Well, it's interesting. The people he was preaching to, surely they would see that he had swapped those two things out immediately. It's interesting. It would be interesting to know how they perceived that or how if he even explained why he did it.
Right. It would be nice to get a hold of some old Jewish commentaries, like 1,000 or 2,000 years old, to see how they dealt with that. Yeah. Diane?
My Bible had a little bit of what prior to the thing, and it had theme, and then it's got four different breakdowns: destruction of Jerusalem, God's mercy, sin, consequences, and hope. But under the destruction of Jerusalem, it says, Lamentation is a sad funeral song for the great capital city of the Jews.
Right.
And on and on. I thought, oh, a funeral song.
Yeah, so we write, just like old-style funeral music has a different sound to it than what you might hear at a wedding, so also poetry that is for the death of someone or a funeral or whatever, it has a different tone to it. And I had an additional thought, and it went out one of these doors here. And kind of going back to the imagery thing, I know the book of Revelation is not really what you would consider poetry, but I think it will illustrate my point. John was not just saying, here's Rome, here's the church, here's this, and here's that. Instead, he gives you pictures. It's all in pictures. It's just a different way of communicating a thought or truth that it might have a different effect on us. For example, I've done this. In fact, I think I've preached it here twice. Why there was silence in heaven, you remember in Revelation 8, John says that there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. And the way I preached that to you was to cover all the loud sounds that occur before that. And then, boom, you hit that right there, and it makes you think. If you just come cold to Revelation 8, you're going to think, why was there silence in heaven? But I think when you start at chapter 1 and start looking at all the sounds that had to have been loud, like John in the Spirit on the Lord's Day, and he hears behind him a voice speaking like the sound of a trumpet, and trumpets aren't quiet, you know, you're gonna see that, hear that loud noise. And before he's done with chapter 1, he, as he continues his image of Jesus, there's some more loud sounds. And in fact, often he tells you that then someone in heaven said with a loud voice, such and such. Okay, so again, Lamentations is that same way. It's written with the acrostics in the first four chapters, following the Hebrew alphabet, except for where I've told you in chapters 2, 3, and 4, he changes the 16th and 17th letter. So it's like he's saying, I want to show you the suffering of Jerusalem from A to Z. But then, in chapter 5, he doesn't follow that pattern. It's one commentator said it was just kind of like, the grief is so overwhelming to Jeremiah as he's writing these poems that it's like he just can't contain himself. He can't follow a pattern when he writes that fifth one. It's like he's losing it. And he just, thoughts come into his head, of course he's being directed by the Holy Spirit, and boom, he writes those things down. So just hopefully that'll give you some insight on this. Okay, so now I want to do what I did last week, since we are so unfamiliar with Lamentations. And I say we, maybe I should say I am so unfamiliar with it. Is anybody here really familiar with it? Like, you know what's in chapter 4?
We read it once a year, and we do the little devotional.
Right, exactly, yeah. So you read through it, yeah. Okay, so that's all I've ever done. I mean, I've done some other studying on it in the past, because as I was preparing for this class, I went through my material and thought, I've already read some books on Lamentations, but it was like two or three decades ago. So even, you know, I have to remind myself of it. So what I want to do is what we did last week. We read the first chapter of that one poem all at one time. And I want to do that same thing with chapter 2. Just read it, because it was a poem to be read all at once. And before we read it, well, if I can give you some advice on Bible reading. And in fact, I'm going to recommend the same thing in my sermon today on something about the book of Romans. A lot of times when you're reading the Bible, you're reading along and you don't understand something. And we get hung up on it. Maybe we want to look at a commentary, or we want to call somebody and ask, or you call and ask me, or something. Or maybe you just stop. You say, I can't figure out what's going on there. Just keep reading. Sometimes you'll find out that by doing that, just keep reading, stay with the author as though the author was standing before you speaking these things, And you wouldn't, it comes to a certain part, you wouldn't just get up and walk out. You would keep listening. And then you were able to figure out what he meant in this whole speech. Okay, and that can often happen in Bible books. You're going to be coming across something, and you're going to get tripped up on something there. Like, for me, I've told you about Daniel 11 and Ezekiel 40 through 48. Those are two places in the Bible where I just have a difficult time following the prophets and what they meant. But I just keep on going because I then generally can figure out the flow of what's going on. You follow what I'm saying? Just like again what I said about Revelation. Just keep on reading. You're going to come across stuff that you don't understand. You'll be in chapter 9 and you think, what is with all these scorpions and different things like that? And you're going to be like, and why all these colors? And whatever. Just keep reading it, okay? And you'll get it, at least the general message. That's the main thing they want you to get. Okay, so here's chapter 2 of Lamentations. How the Lord has covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud in his anger. He has cast down from heaven to the earth the beauty of Israel and did not remember his footstool in the day of his anger. The Lord has swallowed up and has not pitied. All the dwelling places of Jacob he has thrown down in his wrath. The strongholds of the daughter of Judah, he has brought them down to the ground. He has profaned the kingdom and its princes. He has cut off in fierce anger every horn of Israel. He has drawn back his right hand from before the enemy. He has blazed against Jacob like a flaming fire devouring all around. Standing like an enemy, he has bent his bow with his right hand like an adversary. He has slain all who were pleasing to his eye. On the tent of the daughter of Zion, he has poured out his fury like fire. The Lord was like an enemy. He has swallowed up Israel. He has swallowed up all her palaces. He has destroyed her strongholds and has increased mourning and lamentation in the daughter of Judah. He has done violence to his tabernacle as if it were a garden. He has destroyed his place of assembly. The Lord has caused the appointed feasts and Sabbaths to be forgotten in Zion. In his burning indignation, he has spurned the king and the priest. The Lord has spurned his altar. He has abandoned his sanctuary. He has given up the walls of her palaces into the hand of the enemy. They have made a noise in the house of the Lord as on the day of a set feast. The Lord has purposed to destroy the wall of the daughter of Zion. He has stretched out a line. He has not withdrawn his hand from destroying. Therefore, he has caused the rampart and wall to lament. They languished together. Her gates have sunk into the ground. He has destroyed and broken her bars. Her king and her princes are among the nations. The law is no more, and her prophets find no vision from the Lord. The elders of the daughter of Zion sit on the ground and keep silence. They throw dust on their heads and gird themselves with sackcloth. The virgins of Jerusalem bow their heads to the ground. My eyes fail with tears. My heart is troubled. My bile is poured out on the ground because of the destruction of the daughter of my people, because the children and the infants faint in the streets of the city. They say to their mothers, "Where is grain and wine?" And they swoon like the wounded in the streets of the city as their life is poured out in their mother's bosom. How shall I console you? To what shall I liken you, O daughter of Jerusalem? What shall I compare with you that I may comfort you, O virgin daughter of Zion? For your ruin is spread wide as the sea. Who can heal you? Your prophets have seen for you false and deceptive visions. They have not uncovered your iniquity to bring back your captives, but have envisioned for you false prophecies and delusions. All who pass by clap their hands at you. They hiss and shake their heads at the daughter of Jerusalem. Is this the city that is called the perfection of beauty, the joy of the whole earth? All your enemies have opened their mouth against you. They hiss and gnash their teeth. They say, "We have swallowed her up. Surely this is the day we have waited for. We have found it. We have seen it. The Lord has done what He purposed. He has fulfilled His word, which He commanded in days of old. He has thrown down and has not pitied, and He has caused an enemy to rejoice over you. He has exalted the horn of your adversaries." Their heart cried out to the Lord, "O wall of the daughter of Zion, let tears run down like a river day and night. Give yourself no relief, give your eyes no rest. Arise, cry out in the night. At the beginning of the watches, pour out your heart like your water before the face of the Lord. Lift your hands toward Him for the life of your young children who faint from hunger at the head of every street. See, O Lord, and consider, to whom have you done this? Should the women eat their offspring, the children they have cuddled? Should the priest and prophet be slain in the sanctuary of the Lord? Young and old lie on the ground in the streets. My virgins and my young men have fallen by the sword. You have slain them in the day of your anger. You have slaughtered and not pitied. You have invited as to a feast day the terrors that surround me. In the day of the Lord's anger, there was no refugee or survivor. Those whom I have born and brought up, my enemies have destroyed." Okay, now hopefully you noticed a theme there. Chapter 1 was just talking about Jerusalem and how they had suffered. And that's being discussed here, but what is being discussed is who caused it. And it wasn't so much Babylon, though that is certainly implied, but who was the one that caused Jerusalem's suffering?
The Lord.
The Lord. Exactly. And did you notice as I started reading, I meant to point it out to you to watch for it as I went through it, but did you see all the imagery that he painted for you? I mean, as I was reading verse 1, I thought, how come I didn't tell the class to be looking for this stuff? Look at verse 1 again. And I want you to think now, get in your minds a picture of some images that he has. How the Lord has covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud in His anger. He has cast down from heaven to the earth the beauty of Israel and did not remember His footstool on the day of His anger. Okay, did you see it? I saw at least three images there. What's the first one? Okay, so here's Zion or Jerusalem, and it's being covered with a cloud. See a cloud over the city. You've seen pictures of Jerusalem. Imagine now a cloud's over it, but the cloud is His anger. What's the second image? Right in the middle. What happened to her beauty? It was thrown down from where to where?
Heaven to earth.
Okay, so he wanted you to imagine the beauty of Jerusalem was from heaven. Now God, he wants you to picture something being thrown down from heaven down to the earth. Like it's something to be stomped on now. Now what's the third image?
Footstool.
What's a footstool?
Something to step on.
Okay, something to step on or to rest your feet on. And who's using this footstool?
The Lord.
Okay, so he didn't. We're His footstool. We're His resting place. And He's not remembered us. So see that? Every single verse had images like that in it. Okay?
They're not
good. What was that?
They're not
good. No, it's all sad, depressing imagery, and he wants it to be that way because... I'm sorry?
How disgusted he is with Jerusalem and where it's been.
Right, yeah. Yeah. And if I had lost someone dear to me, you know, like my wife or my children or grandchildren, I'd want you to know, how you doing today, Don? Well, you know, I'll tell you. And I want you to feel my sadness. That's what Jeremiah is doing here, okay? Okay, so look at verses, 3 and 4. There's an image that occurs there more than once. See at the end of verse 3, he has blazed against Jacob like a flaming fire. And just how much was this flaming fire? I mean, how big was it? What's the very next thing he says?
All-consuming.
Yeah, it's all-consuming. It devoured everything around there. So it wasn't just like... you know, like if we had a fire here in town, there's one building that's completely destroyed. No, the whole place is ablaze. And look at verse 4.
So the same thing.
Yeah, he brings up the same imagery again at the end. On the tent of the daughter of Zion, he has poured out his fury like fire. What would fire do to a tent as compared to a structure like what we're in right now?
Be gone.
Yeah, it would... Yeah, it wouldn't just burn one little corner, and it wouldn't do it slowly. You know, it'd wipe out the whole thing. And that's what he wants you to see there, okay? What did the Lord do to every horn of Israel? Verse 3.
Cut it off,
someone said. All right. So, you know, this is mentioned frequently in the Old Testament. It talks about the horn of Israel, or even in some of the... prophecies and visions, let's say, like that Daniel had. And he would see a beast, and he talks about these horns. And these horns are always talking about power. The power of the nation. Or in this case, the power of the nation and the power or authority and strength of Jerusalem. And now, so you see an animal with a horn, and now God's come and cut them off. Leaves them very defenseless. I saw a video this past week. I don't remember who posted or where I even saw it. But it was two, I think they were water buffalo. And a lion had taken one down. And another one came over and carefully took its horn and put it right in the middle of the lion and flung it up. And that lion went like this through the air. Landed. And the bull or whatever it was came, I think, with the other side this time and gored it again and threw that thing up in the air like it was nothing for it and it flung around. Now, what happens if you cut off those horns? They're not going to do that. And that lion's going to want to do whatever it wants to do, and that's what happened to Jerusalem. Okay, that's what he wants you to see happening. God drew back his right hand from what? From before the enemy. What's that picturing?
You're on your own. I ain't going to stop you.
Okay, so he drew back his right hand from before the enemy. It's as though he had been holding the enemy back. Here's, let's say my little pulpit stand here is Jerusalem, and the enemy is coming down the aisle here, and he's holding them back. He can do it with one hand, it's no problem for God. He can hold back a mighty power like Babylon. Now he draws it back and lets them come and attack his city.
He always protected his people, but not now.
That's right. For example, years before this, the Assyrian Empire, one of the greatest, we don't talk a lot about Assyria, but they were a very powerful nation that lasted for a long time. They were a nation for 2,400 years. And they are also known as some of the most brutal and cruel people that the earth has ever seen. And they could conquer whoever they wanted. And they came into Israel, took Israel. That's when the northern kingdom went into captivity. They came south, and they captured every city in Judah except for Jerusalem. And it was only because of the prayer of King Hezekiah, a magnificent prayer that he prayed to God. I believe it's in 2 Chronicles 20. I can find out later for sure if you'd like. He basically says, God, we don't know what to do. It's true. These people can do whatever they want. Now they've come against us. We have no power against the enemy. We don't know what to do, but our eyes are on you. And that touched God. It would me. And they didn't. They weren't able to attack Jerusalem. And that, in fact, that's where they God killed. It was either 135,000 or 185,000 of the Assyrians as they surrounded Jerusalem. And they went back with their tail between their legs. Okay, so see, we already talked about the fire devouring all around. Like, how did God stand? Verse 4. That's right. So not only now has he drawn back his right hand and let the enemy in, he's now standing like an enemy against the city. How hard would that be? I mean, to think about that. I like to think about God protecting me, watching over me and everything, but what if he is against me and he's standing against me? We don't have a chance, right, as you know.
Remember King Saul.
Yeah.
He was through.
Right. Okay, verses 5 through 7. Here, God's an enemy to Jerusalem. He talks about that a little bit more. In what ways did Jeremiah say that God had become an enemy to Jerusalem? What does an attacking army do? What was that, Phil?
Swallowed up everything.
Yeah. He's like an enemy, and here's how he's like an enemy. He has swallowed up Israel. He has swallowed up all her palaces. He has destroyed her strongholds. Well, that's what an enemy does when they come in and fight you. Yes?
Up here, verse 2, it says swallowed up. And then down here, verse 7, it says consumed. You know, he swallowed up, everything is consuming.
Yeah, okay, you're right. Back in verse 2, the Lord has swallowed up and not pitied. And now he repeats that imagery, doesn't he, in verse 5. So he, again, if you can just picture the imagery, he wants you to just see the enemy like a huge monster just coming up and just swallowing up the city. And all the palaces, all the beautiful places, just swallows all those up. How did the Lord treat his tabernacle?
He did violence to it.
Exactly. He did. Think about that. That first line there, verse 6, is pretty awesome. God has done violence to his tabernacle. They built that tabernacle, or temple, at his instruction, at his direction.
His dwelling.
Pardon? His dwelling place, right. Now he is doing violence to it. And it's interesting that Jeremiah doesn't just say that he's doing, working against. Here in the New King James Version, I have the word violence. Do all of you have that in your same translations? Violence? There in verse 6. Okay, so, I mean, violence. That's a strong picture, is it not? Excuse me. What then happened to the feast and Sabbaths?
Forgotten.
That's right. They've been forgotten right there towards the last half of verse 6. And the Lord was the one again who said, you shall keep my Sabbaths. And he meant that, didn't he? It was a death penalty for violating it. And he wanted them to keep these feasts. But now he has done something so they can't do those things. What did he give to the hand of the enemy? Verse 7. Say it again.
Given the walls of the palaces.
Okay, so he spurned his altar, he abandoned his sanctuary, he gave up the walls of her palaces. Okay, so earlier he mentioned the tabernacle just as an overall picture, but now he's talking about actual places in the tabernacle or temple and the furniture there and other items that God wanted them to have present, the altar and so on. He's against all of that. And notice at the end of verse 7, he talks about a noise. What does he mean there? There's a noise there, and he compares it to what?
As on the day of a set feast.
Okay, yeah, so listen to it. Verse 7, the last two lines, the way it's divided up in my Bible. They have made, talk about the enemy. The enemy has made a noise in the house of the Lord as on the day of a set feast. Okay, so let's talk about Israel when they observed their feast. Was it a time of sadness or joy?
Joy.
They'd be singing, they'd be celebrating. They're making a joyful noise, so to speak. But now, in this case, who's making the joyful noise? The enemy, because they've come in and they've conquered. And the treasure that they're getting out of the temple. You know, all the gold that's in there and everything. The Ark of the Covenant. The cherubim that are sitting on it. What's inside the Ark of the Covenant? Tell me at least one thing.
Tablets.
Yeah, the Ten Commandments, written with the finger of God. They've heard about this stuff. And so they're rejoicing about it. And of course, you put yourself in the prophet's position here, and you cannot think of anything sadder than that. Phil?
I know it's on the day of a feast. That means there's a whole lot of people there.
Okay, normally there would be a whole lot of people there, but instead of it being Jews this time, it's a whole lot of Babylonians.
A whole lot of enemy,
right. Okay, verses 8 and 9. Jerusalem's defenses here are ruined. What did the Lord not withdraw?
His hand.
Okay, so that kind of goes back to verse 3 where he drew back his right hand from before the enemy, and now he has his hand against the city and against the temple, and he's not drawn it back. What happened to the law and the prophets? Verse 9. They're no more. Literally, the copies of it are being destroyed. Now, they've got some hidden somewhere so that they weren't always lost forever, because obviously we have Scripture. But the Lord's not speaking to His people anymore. Why was He not?
They weren't listening.
Yeah, so why speak if you're not going to listen? You remember Jesus at His trial? At one point, they wanted to know, how come you're not answering? And he said, well, if I tell you, you won't believe me. I mean, haven't you been in a situation like that before? Maybe you've been in an argument with someone, or you're trying to help someone or correct them or whatever, and they won't listen to a word you say. It doesn't matter how you say it. They just will not listen. So what did you do? After a while, you just clammed up. There was nothing to say. Why waste your energy anymore? Okay. Verse 10, Jerusalem silence. Why were the elders silent?
They were mourning.
Yeah, because, what could they say? There's nothing they could say to the Babylonians. The Babylonians aren't going to listen. In fact, the prophecy, if you remember when we had gone in the book of Jeremiah, he had said, He said, they're not going to have any mercy on you. When they come in here, they're not going to be polite. And they found out that to be the case. What else did they do and why? They're quiet, but what else? Tell me they're physically, what are they doing? Okay, they're throwing dust on their heads. They're wearing sackcloth.
Bowing their heads to the ground.
An extremely sad, depressed people. These are the elders who would normally be the ones encouraging the people. 11 and 12, Jerusalem's children. What brought overwhelming grief to Jeremiah? Somebody over here, was that you, Karen, or
no,
Pat?
It's Diane.
No,
Diane.
He said, because my people are destroyed, because children and infants faint in the street
of
the city. The children.
Okay, so the children are wanting food, but they're acting like they're wounded, not because they're wounded, but because they're starving. They're thirsty. Their life is poured out in their mother's bosom. That tells me they're the mother. Their mothers are holding them, and the children are dying right in their arms. What would that be like? Verse 13. So Jerusalem can't be comforted. What would you or could you say to such a city?
Better repent.
Well, that's already been said. What is it that Jeremiah says can't be done? What was that, Beverly? Yeah. How are you going to comfort these people? How are you going to tell a woman who's holding her starving, thirsty baby who's dying, what can you possibly say to her? And notice the next thing he says. What other situation in life can you take and say, Jerusalem's children's suffering is like... There's nothing else you can compare with that. It's beyond description is what he's telling us. Beyond explanation or whatever. Where am I? 14? Okay, her prophets failed her. The false prophets here are finally being exposed to where the people can see it. Okay? And what a bad way to find out that they were wrong. Now, Jeremiah had been contradicting them all along, but the king and everyone else went ahead with the false prophets anyways. And now Jeremiah's been proven right. But notice Jeremiah doesn't have an attitude of, see, I told you so. That's not his attitude. 15 and 16, the world's going to wonder what happened. What was the reaction of the nations? What are they doing?
Clapping their hands.
Shaking their heads.
You know, there's another place in the Bible where we read some enemies doing that. You remember where it was?
I couldn't remember.
Jesus is on the cross. And it says that, especially the Jewish leaders, are walking by and they're just wagging their heads at him. Like, you fool. You thought you're the Son of God. If you're the Son of God, bring yourself down from there. They thought they had finally proven their point and proven him wrong. Of course, obviously it didn't. They were the ones who were wrong. We know that big time. And Jesus could have wagged his head and got rid of all of them. But here, people are walking by Jerusalem. I mean, people are still... Remember how, you know, you've got... the Mesopotamian world, Assyria, Babylon, all these nations over here, the Persians. And then down here you've got Africa, huge continent. And in order for anything to go between the two places, they're going to travel right through Israel. And they're going to go through Jerusalem. And they're going to see what's happened to it. And they're wondering, what happened to this place? They're shaking their heads in astonishment. According to verse 16, what were the nations going to do? Did these nations like Israel?
No.
No.
They were rejoicing.
Yeah, they're rejoicing. We've been waiting for this. That's right. So now it's like now we don't have to deal with these people anymore. We can just travel right through their land. We don't have to pay tribute. We don't have to deal with them in any way at all. We're glad this has happened to them. We're glad we can come in here and take over, so to speak. 17. The false prophets had proven to be false, but who had proven to be true?
The Lord.
The Lord. And isn't that the way it always happens? In the end, we're wrong and he's right. Unless, of course, we agree with him. Look at Romans chapter 3. You've heard me quote Troy Cummings, one of my Greek and hermeneutics teacher in preaching school a lot. And here's a passage that he used to quote to us, I think, probably more than any other passage in the Bible. Maybe Acts 20, where Paul speaks about preaching the whole counsel of God. That might be the other one. But this one here, verse 4 of Romans chapter 3. Well, let me just start at verse 3. For what if some did not believe? Will their unbelief make the faithfulness of God without effect? Certainly not. Indeed, let God be true, but every man a liar, as it is written, that you may be justified in your words and may overcome when you are judged. So I can judge God, I can criticize Him, I can disagree with Him, I can try to refute Him and do all those things, but Paul said, when you come right down to it, God is true. God speaks the truth and He always does what is right, even if the entire world, let's say, all agrees on one thing, and it's just the opposite of what God says. They're not going to outvote Him or outpower Him or whatever. He's true. That's why, you know, Paul, as he continued there in Romans 3, eventually says, everyone has sinned and falls short of the glory of God. And that's why we need Jesus, of course. Yes, okay.
A lot of mercy because the Lord has done what He planned. He has fulfilled His word, which He decreed long ago. He has overthrown you without pity. He has let the enemy gloat over you. He has exalted the horn of your enemy. Whoa.
Yeah. So again, God, no matter, He's not doing this out of hatred.
And it's not just a small slap on the...
Right. He's being pretty severe, isn't he?
It had to hurt him deeply.
Yeah. That's right. Okay, 18 and 19. What did their hearts cry out to the Lord? Aren't they saying, you know, looking at the wall, which should have been their defense, let tears run down like a what? Not just one tear coming down, but just, you know, buckets of tears coming down.
No relief, no rest.
And what do you see being pictured in verse 19?
They're calling on the Lord for mercy.
Yeah, crying out in the night, at the beginning of the watches. You know, pour out your heart like water. Isn't that what the Lord wants to see? He just wants to see us pour our hearts out. He pours His heart out for us.
He wants a big repent.
Yeah, He does.
Say that again.
He wants a big repent.
Yes, and He wants it to come. God's not impressed if we give Him 90% of our hearts. Because He doesn't give us 90% of Himself. I mean, look at Jesus on the cross. That's 100%. That's what He wants to see in us. Okay, and then verses 20 through 22, what did Jerusalem want the Lord to see? Verse 20. What do you see there?
Well,
What are you doing this us for? We're your people.
Okay, and women, Lord, are eating their children. Cannibalism. Because the Babylonians have cut off all supplies. The supplies in the city have run out. And the Lord's one who's caused this. And they're saying, God, look at this. Verse 21, it's the young and the old, the virgins and the young men. It's everybody. No, there's no exceptions. Do the Lord's actions, describe the Lord's actions according to verse 22. Okay, and so this day was like what kind of a day for the enemy?
A feast.
It's like the Lord has invited all our enemies to come here and have a feast. And they were.
They did.
Yeah. Okay, that's the end of class. Thanks.